Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 410, titled Deja Vu All Over Again, being recorded on May 18th of 2003. We've been dealing with the complex issues of Islamofascism, the petroleum industry, Muslim imperialism financed by petrodollars, that on the part of Saudi Arabia, and the institutional links with powerful institutions in the West that have proved refractory to any sort of meaningful interdiction of Islamofascist terrorism. And in turn, we are going to be examining the possible effects of the Iraq War, not only in recruiting for Islamic fundamentalist terrorist groups, but also perhaps in creating a refractory attitude on the part of intelligence and security services, particularly in the Muslim world, but also perhaps in the West, toward interdicting the virtual state that is both Al-Qaeda and, at a deeper level, the Underground Reich. Remember, there'll be a detailed annotated description of For the Record 410 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com within a week or so of the airing of this show. Remember also that WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older programs available for download only at a longer URL linked to both the For the Record section of the Spitfire website and to the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website. We're going to return to an article that we were looking at from the front page of the Wall Street Journal of May 15th of 2003. The article is Mapping the Trail of Terror Money Proves Daunting. It's by Keith Johnson. And we're talking here about a Mr. Mohammed Galeb Khalaij Zoyadi, who appears to have been someone involved with Saudi business, someone involved with people who were certainly part of an Al-Qaeda cell and with links to the September 11th events. And we're also going to look at the complications that arise when business, religion, and military and diplomatic affairs dovetail, and they have in a big, big way with the whole issue of Islamofascism, its relationship to the petroleum business, and at a deeper level to the Underground Reich and to the milieu of the Republican Party and the Bush family. Continuing with this article, again, front page of the Wall Street Journal of 515, on page A7, we continue. During trips back to Madrid from Jeddah in the mid-1990s, Mr. Galeb attended the Abu Bakr Mosque, where he struck up a friendship with Imad Eddin Barakat Yarkas. Mr. Yarkas is a fellow Syrian native who worked occasionally as a clothing and used car merchant. Spanish police say they began watching Mr. Yarkas in 1995 after he tried to hand out literature in the mosque encouraging holy war against the West. The police say Mr. Yarkas belonged to a radical Muslim group in Madrid that pushed a hard-line doctrine at the mosque. The imam there, Riyad Tatari Bakri, said Mr. Yarkas was outspoken but didn't promote radical Islam at the mosque, which is what Mr. Yarkas's lawyer also says. Mr. Galeb moved back to Spain in December of 1998, becoming a Spanish citizen in 1999. He started a series of building and real estate firms to take advantage of the booming Spanish property market. By the way, I would add that in For the Record 343, we took a look at the way in which business enterprises are used by the Islamofascist Muslim Brotherhood to support its activities in a fashion not only analogous to the way in which the Bormann organization operates, but it appears probable that the Muslim Brotherhood and ultimately the Underground Reich and the Bormann Group are directly connected. In fact, I'd say that one can put that beyond probable through people like François Genoux and others. There are definite links. Continuing, the Spanish police records show a complicated pattern of financial dealings beginning in the early 1990s. In 1993 and 1994, Mr. Galeb wrote two checks drawing a total of $100,000 from his account at the Al Raji Banking and Investment Corporation in Jeddah, according to copies of financial records. Note the Al Raji Banking and Investment Corporation, because the Al Raji family and businesses, nonprofits, and other institutions connected with the Al Raji milieu are in turn part of the Saudi elite and inextricably linked with the BCCI milieu, which lies at the core of many of these events. Continuing. The checks were made out to his sister, Sozan, who was then living in the Canary Islands. Mr. Galeb's handwritten notes indicate that she was to use the money to invest in apartments being built in Madrid, which she did. The developer of the apartments, Ghassoub Al-Abrash Galyoun, was acquainted with both Mr. Galeb and Mr. Yarkas, police say. Mr. Abrash was arrested last year after Spanish police searched his house and found hours of videos of New York's World Trade Center, San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge, and other prominent U.S. landmarks. The videos were recorded during a 1997 trip. Transcripts of accompanying audio recordings reveal joking about women and discussion of visiting Michael Jordan's restaurant in Chicago. But interspersed are darker moments. A fixation on structural elements such as the supporting pillars of the Golden Gate Bridge and apprehension about unnamed, quote, security forces, unquote, confiscating the videos before they could be passed on to the brothers, unquote, in Syria. By the way, that in all likelihood a reference to the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, the Syrian branch of that worldwide Islamo-fascist institution. And by the way, one should note that the whole issue surrounding the sensitive investigation of terrorism is one that in football is called hitting the seams of the zone. Islamo-fascist elements and others have been quite candid in their desire to use the liberal aspects of Western democracies to undermine those very democracies. And as I've indicated, I believe that the Islamo-fascists, as well as secular Arabo-fascists and many of their Nazi and white supremacist counterparts in the U.S. and Europe are being used as tools by the underground Reich. Now, in that discussion of Mr. Galeb, note the role of the Al-Raji Institution, one of the institutions with which he did business. We're going to take a look now at the book Forbidden Truth, U.S. Taliban Secret Oil Diplomacy and the Failed Hunt for Bin Laden. This was co-authored by Jean-Charles Brizard and Guillaume Dasquier. And it talks about the milieu of the Operation Green Quest raids, again precipitated by the lawsuit by the heroic John Loftus against Sami Al-Arian. Arian has his case has yet to be adjudicated, but I should note that we have noted in past broadcasts that the affidavits that were given to law enforcement and treasury officials in connection with the Sami Al-Arian lawsuit led to the Operation Green Quest raids of March 20th of 2002 and the $1 trillion lawsuit against the Saudi elite on behalf of survivors of September 11th. The Operation Green Quest raids of 3/20/2002 in turn go directly to the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization, to people associated with the Bush administration and Bush business dealings such as Harkin Energy and the BCCI milieu. And we should also note that the March 20th, 2002 Green Quest raids go to the Al-Taqwa and Al-Qaeda and Hamas milieu, plural, although Sami Al-Arian has not been tried as yet. One should note that he was videotaped calling for donations. Who wants to contribute $500 to kill a Jew? It'd be interesting to see that concept applied in a different context. If, for example, one were doing a fundraiser on, say, the Pacifica Radio Network, can you imagine if somebody got on those airwaves and said, who wants to contribute $500 to kill an Arab? Or who wants to contribute $500 to kill a Mexican? I don't think that would be viewed as altogether kosher, so to speak, under the circumstances. It is interesting that Sami Al-Arian has been hailed as a hero and a martyr in the so-called progressive sector, I guess illustrating nothing so much as the obvious fact that the Naderoids are still very much in business. Now, Forbidden Truth by Jean-Charles Brizard and Guillaume Dasquier, published by Nation Books or Thunder's Mouth Press, talks about the 3/20/2002 Green Quest raids and the links to the SAR Foundation and to the milieu of the al-Raji family. And this, in turn, illustrates some of the complexities involved with the Saudi situation linked to not only American tremendous petrodollar investment in the U.S. and elsewhere, but to the use of two of the three holiest sites in Islam as leverage, along with the tremendous oil wealth that the Saudis have. Bear in mind that although we're not going to focus on those principally here, those links run directly to, at one level, the Bush administration. Continuing, on page 57 of Forbidden Truth, we read, "For those who still doubt the Saudi presence in these networks, what are we to make of the searches undertaken in Virginia in March of 2002 aimed at several charitable organizations including the SAR Foundation, Safa Trust, and the International Institute of Islamic Thought, as well as companies directed by the same people, among them Marjak Investments, Sterling Management, Sterling Poultry, and Sonabel Incorporated, suspected of having given their support to terrorism? The SAR Foundation was created in 1983. Its president is Yaqub Mirza, and its treasurer is Mohammed Jaglit. It turns out that Sharif Sedki, who is a trustee of the SAR Foundation, is the legal counsel to Khalid bin Mahfouz, one of the principal supporters of Osama bin Laden, and has recently presented himself as Khalid's spokesman. By the way, Jean-Charles Brizard is currently the focal point of a legal action by Sharif Sedki and Khalid bin Mahfouz disputing his connections to Osama bin Laden. I talked about that in For the Record 403, and I suspect that a deal has been cut in which some of the Saudi connections to September 11th will be suppressed in exchange for, among other things, Saudi support and the use of their bases in the recent war against Iraq. Continuing, "What's more, Sharif Sedki is a member of the board of two companies belonging to Khalid bin Mahfouz, Namir Petroleum, once associated with the UNICAL consortium to construct a pipeline in Afghanistan, and the Crédit Libanais SAL Bank. At the same time, according to the American authorities, the SAR Foundation and its partners appear to have been financed by the al-Raji Saudi family, whose patriarch Suleiman bin Abdulaziz al-Raji heads up an important investment bank in Riyadh, the al-Raji Banking and Investment Corporation." It was that bank on which Mr. Galeb drew for many of the funds for his activities. Continuing, "It also turns out that Yaqub Mirza is directly tied to these interests since he heads Sonabel Incorporated at the same Virginia address as the SAR Foundation. The al-Raji family controls the Saudi holding company Sonabel Trade and Agricultural Industries Company Limited. It's not surprising to discover that the al-Raji family holds stock, alongside the bin Laden Group and Khalid bin Mahfouz, in the Arabian Cement Company in Jeddah, whose president is none other than Prince Turki Abdulaziz Al Saud," by the way, chief of Saudi intelligence, the man who allegedly helped to run Osama bin Laden for decades and replaced as the chief of Saudi intelligence the week before the September 11th attacks. Now, bearing in mind the many entanglements of the Saudi situation, and indeed one of the things we have not had time to go into is the actual split between the Sudairi clan in Saudi Arabia and other clans over the accession to the succession to the monarchy, but bearing in mind the profound international financial links, including to the petroleum industry, the business connections through recycled petrodollars, the civil liberties aspects in which religious activities and charitable activities have been apparently abused, as well as business activities abused for terrorist purposes, but presenting a quandary for legal authorities investigating these activities. And bearing in mind the frustration of John O'Neill's investigation into Osama bin Laden, in which he basically resigned, saying that the links go to Saudi Arabia, but because of American corporate interests to Saudi Arabia, these investigations have been actively frustrated. Now, note, in connection with a series of articles that I'm going to introduce in rapid fashion, note that so many of the activities and so many of the suspects alleged here to be linked with Osama bin Laden and company involve escapes or notable and highly questionable lapses in security, and take into account the entanglements I've already discussed. San Francisco Chronicle, Friday, May 16th of 2002. Article by David Stout that originally ran the New York Times. Dateline Washington headline, two charged in coal attack. Indicted men were among 10 who broke out of Yemeni jail. Bear in mind that it was Barbara Bodine, an old-time Republican old girl, so to speak, who frustrated John O'Neill's investigation into the coal bombing in Yemen. The article reads in part, skipping down, the Justice Department announced the murder and conspiracy charges against Fahd al-Kusso and Jamal Ahmed Mohammed Ali al-Badawi. Attorney General John Ashcroft described the two as dedicated al-Qaeda terrorists recruited for the coal attack by Osama bin Laden's closest associates. The fugitives were among 10 suspected al-Qaeda members who escaped from a supposedly high-security jail in Yemen last month. Again, is the Iraq War serving to light a match to the tinderbox of the Muslim world and the Middle East in particular? In the scenario that I introduced in numerous broadcasts, many including the programs titled Between Iraq and a Hard Place, again, I would bring to mind my working hypothesis that, in fact, not only Islamo-fascists, but secular Arabo-fascists in league with their compatriots around the world are being used as proxy warriors against the United States. The most important element of that underground Reich proxy war, the fifth column, which resides within the Bush family and 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. That's why I've gone into the connections between the March 20th Green Quest raids, Grover Norquist, Norquist's role as a tax cutter, and the undermining of the long-term American economy by the Bush fiscal policies and the worldwide strategy being pursued, in my opinion, by the underground Reich. Again, same question. San Francisco Chronicle, Wednesday, May 14th of 2003. Saudis blame al-Qaeda for Riyadh bomb blast. This is a Washington Post story by Alan Cypress and Peter Finn. Its headline, cell members escaped after raid last week at Stateline Cairo. And note again, just like the coal suspects who escaped from a supposedly high security jail in Yemen, the Islamic militants behind the devastating car bombings in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, were part of an al-Qaeda cell whose members fought a gun battle last week with Saudi authorities before escaping arrest, Saudi officials say. At the time, police raided a suspected hideout, uncovering a weapons cache that included 55 hand grenades, 829 pounds of explosives, and 2,545 bullets of different calibers. The May 6th raid took place at a safe house several hundred yards from one of the buildings hit, unquote, by the triple bombing, a senior U.S. official said. The cell was formed in the kingdom after September 11, 2001 attacks on the United States, officials said. It is led by Khaled Jahani, who left Saudi Arabia when he was 18, later fought in Bosnia and Chechnya, and was based at al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan, the officials added. And note again that there was a, quote, miraculous, unquote, escape in Saudi Arabia. Again, moving on in quick fashion, New York Times, same day, Friday, May 16, 2003, Douglas Jeal and David E. Sanger, article headline, Five Requests to Saudis Went Unheeded, U.S. says. Reads in part, in the month before Monday's bombings in Riyadh, the United States asked Saudi Arabia on at least five separate occasions to deploy armed, uniformed government guards around all Western targets of a possible terrorist attack, Bush administration officials said today. Among those requests, the officials said, was one by Stephen J. Hadley, the deputy national security advisor who was diverted to Saudi Arabia during a trip to Moscow and Israel and was instructed by the White House to meet directly with Crown Prince Abdullah, the kingdom's day-to-day leader. We needed to underscore the seriousness of the message that they had to wake up, unquote, one senior official said. Yet neither that request delivered on Saturday, May 3rd, nor any other was fully heeded by the Riyadh government, the officials said. The Saudi authorities did nothing to augment security at any of the sites, including the three housing compounds struck on Monday night, the administration officials said. Well, again, noting the profound economic links, including links going to the petroleum industry and the Bush administration, and noting the cavalier attitude of the Saudis toward the March 20th Green Quest raids, that quote, lacks, unquote, security is not too, should not be too surprising. And again, bear in mind some of my ruminations about the possible effects of the Iraq war and my suspicion that we were walking into a trap that was laid during the closing phases over or in the immediate aftermath of World War II. Financial Times, May 17th and May 18th of 2003, article by Edward Alden in Washington. Headline, Saudis admit U.S. warned of attack. The top foreign policy advisor to Saudi Arabia's crown prince admitted yesterday that his government had received an explicit U.S. warning of an imminent attack at one of the three compounds struck on Monday by al-Qaeda. The Saudi government had previously insisted that the U.S. warnings made in personal visits and letters from senior U.S. officials were too general to act on. Still another story in that same regard, Sunday, May 18th, 2003, San Jose Mercury News, David Kelly of the LA Times, probe of Saudi bombings reveals well-executed plot. As FBI agents combed through the wreckage of three Saudi housing compounds hit by suicide bombers last week, new details about the planning and execution of the attacks emerged Monday. A U.S. official speaking on condition of anonymity said the estimated 19 men who hit the Alhambra Oasis Village, the Jadawell Complex, and the Vanel compound late Monday had watched the facilities for weeks or months and knew precisely how to gain entry and do the most damage. They rented villas and apartments near the compounds where they studied the movements of those inside, he said. Before the assaults, they donned military uniforms to confuse guards at the gates. And again, the complicity of, at one level, the Saudi authorities, and at another level, the underground Reich is something to be considered here. Yet another article, this from the San Francisco Chronicle of today, May 18th, 2003. New York Times story by Don Vanatta, headline, U.S. probes Saudi blasts. A team of 60 U.S. investigators scoured three charred blast sites on Saturday where terrorists had detonated car bombs Monday night. And after discussing the hunt for forensic evidence, skipping down, but in a sign that the Saudis may be displeased with the presence of the large U.S. contingent composed mainly of FBI agents, the Saudi Interior Minister declared that the investigation would be limited to observer roles in the inquiry. They are not investigators, unquote, Prince Nayef bin Abdulaziz said in an interview published today by the Daily Al Rayyad. They will not probe anything. These officials came to inspect the incidents only. So again, more recalcitrance, not to be surprising under the circumstances. Another attack took place, this from the Chronicle of Sunday, May 18th of 2003. This in the relatively moderate and democratic country of Morocco. Morocco reeling after attacks. By Keith Richburg, a Washington Post story datelined, appropriately enough, Casablanca. It's subtitled, Five Suicide Bombings Kill 41 and Injures Scores More. Morocco, a relatively moderate country, and one wonders again if what we're looking at here is a radicalization of the Muslim and Arab population and their use as proxy warriors by the underground Reich. Another interesting consideration, this also detailing a Saudi connection, but indicating, again, I think the very curious attitude of the Germans, and in particular the German attitude towards the ironically named Christian Gonscharski. We discussed Gonscharski in, for the record, 393 and 395. This from the Wall Street Journal of Wednesday, May 14th of 2003, German accused of terrorist link is released. A German man accused of ties to an al-Qaeda attack in Tunisia last year has been released from detention in Saudi Arabia after prosecutors failed to convince a German court to issue an arrest warrant. The case illustrates the continuing difficulties facing prosecutors in the war on terrorism. Christian Gonscharski has been linked to the bombing of a synagogue on the island resort of Djerba last April that killed 19 people. A police bug on his phone in Germany recorded that the suicide bomber Nizar Nawar called Mr. Gonscharski shortly before the attack, asking that Mr. Gonscharski pray for him. German police say they didn't have enough evidence to charge the 36-year-old, and in November he left Germany for Saudi Arabia, where he had previously lived after converting to Islam. Mr. Gonscharski told interrogators that he had no advance knowledge of the bombing or any other terrorist acts. In early April, the Saudi government sent a diplomatic note to Germany saying it was going to deport Mr. Gonscharski, whose visa had expired in December. Germany responded by saying it would try to get an arrest warrant to use upon Mr. Gonscharski's entry into the country, prosecutors felt they now had enough evidence to prosecute Mr. Gonsharski. At the end of that phone call, Mr. Gonsharski knew a crime would be committed, unquote, says Franka Katrin Scheuten, spokeswoman for Germany's federal prosecutor's office. But a German court decided against the government last week, ruling that there wasn't enough evidence that Mr. Gonsharski knew an attack was imminent. Prosecutors say they are considering an appeal, but in the meantime, Saudi officials have released him, skipping down. In a deposition made to police last October, Mr. Gonsharski described his previous stay in Saudi Arabia, which he first visited in 1993, with the backing of a senior German Islamic official. He and his family lived for more than a year with a university professor named Saud Khalif in Medina. German officials say Mr. Gonsharski has returned to Mr. Khalif's home, but that he is unhappy there because he is unable to find work. Meanwhile, Mr. Gonsharski's fate is unclear. His German passport is valid until November of 2010, so he could leave Saudi Arabia for any country and simply disappear. Even if he returned to Germany, prosecutors now would have no grounds to detain Mr. Gonsharski or even require that he speak to investigators. And again, bearing in mind some of my ruminations about the Iraq war as a trap for the U.S., consider the following in the context of what we've seen so far. This from Newsweek of May 19th of 2003, article by Rod Nordland, and its headline, WMDs for the taking? While U.S. troops pushed on to Baghdad, Iraqis were looting radioactive materials from once protected sites. Skipping down, some of the lapses are frightening. The well-known Al-Tawatha Nuclear Research Center, about 12 miles south of Baghdad, had nearly 2 tons of partially enriched uranium, along with significant quantities of highly radioactive medical and industrial isotopes, when International Atomic Energy Agency officials made their last visit in January. By the time U.S. troops arrived in early April, armed guards were holding off looters, but the Americans only disarmed the guards, Al-Tawatha department heads told Newsweek. Quote, "We told them this site is out of control. You have to take care of it," unquote, said Mutra Ibrahim, Al-Tawatha's head of plasma physics. Quote, "The soldiers said we're a small group. We cannot take control of this site," unquote. As soon as the Americans left, looters broke in. The staff fled, and when they returned, the contaminant vault seals had been broken, and radioactive material was everywhere. It remains to be seen where exactly this goes. And again, Army Chief of Staff General Shinseki said a lot more troops would be needed to maintain order in post-war Iraq, and it remains to be seen, although obviously the war went well on the battlefield. The aftermath has yet to be determined, and I would caution against any quick analyses of what has happened in Iraq. The true effects, both in the United States and in Europe and the Middle East, will take a number of years to determine. The various programs that I've done are available from a tape duplication service and CD duplication service called Spitfire. That's S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, one word, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. The Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com is equipped with real audio, and there will be a detailed article-length annotated description of For the Record Program 410 within a week or so of the airing of this program. That'll be on the Spitfire website. Note that there's a summary discussion of key talking points in the September 11th inquiry that I've been conducting. That is available in For the Record Program number 391. Sister station WFMU-FM is archiving the For the Record programs on real audio. More recent programs are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older programs available for download only on a longer URL linked to both the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website as well. That concludes side two of For the Record program number 410, Deja Vu All Over Again, being recorded on May 18th of 2003. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.